Well, it's great to see everybody again today. Thanks for coming. Thanks for coming back. I wanted to talk about, I think I'll just get into it. The title for this talk is The Tongue Has No Bone. If you've been around Zen for a while, you might have heard that phrase. And I thought it would be something to talk about because I think we all know what the news is about these days. It's about this brutal war that's appeared between Israel and Gaza. Below that, it's about our dysfunctional government. Below that, it's the usual, this side against this side. And both sides, according to those people, are the heroes of the story, and the other side are demons. Brutal. Both sides are working overtime to disseminate the news from their perspective at the cost of their opponents. And as I just mentioned, they're not just making their case, but they're depicting the other side as less than human in their barbaric acts. Sadly, none of this is news to us anymore, but it's become so ubiquitous that it's really playing havoc with us in terms of what can we believe? What can we believe is true? Disinformation campaigns have been around probably since time began, between countries, between political parties, between ideological factions. And these phrases that I certainly didn't recall 25 years ago, like fake news and alternative facts, become the norm. I guess in the good old days, whatever that means, there was a nod towards at least sounding like you were telling the truth. And even that has been kind of stripped away. And with, of course, with the rise of social media, the ability to spread disinformation faster and more broadly has just grown at a really rampant rate. So far, I don't think I've told you a single thing that you don't already know. But I wanted to set the stage for that because truth is an important thing. Knowing what you can trust is an incredibly important thing. So how does that fit into our Zen practice? How does that fit into the Zen tradition? When we take precepts, one of the first five precepts we take is a vow to abstain from lying. And of course, in Zen, we make it even harder to keep the precepts because we know if we always stay to the letter of the law, sometimes you can't do the most beneficial thing. That story that we frequently hear during precept ceremonies of somebody, shortly after you've seen this cute little bunny rabbit, walk, bounce up to you, sniff its nose and go that way. And you see a hunter coming saying, "Where'd the rabbit go?" You either have to be complicit in lying or complicit in taking life, if you take it seriously. But getting back to this verbal subterfuge, we have this phrase that I mentioned a minute ago, the tongue has no bone. It's a warning that comes from our own tradition to be careful about this. People can say absolutely anything, whether it's true or not. And they can also say one thing in one moment and the exact opposite thing in another moment. From the very first of this tradition that we're part of, Buddha said this to his followers, and I'm going to read it. "Do not believe in anything simply because you've heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many." If that doesn't ring a bell. "Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it." Good advice. I'm sure there are other spiritual paths that follow that same direction set by its founder, but I don't know really if that's true. From the very beginning, Buddha wanted us to be able to tell for ourselves what is right and what is wrong, what is helpful and what is unhelpful, and actually what is going on. So you come to the Zen Center, and I think we all do try our best to be transparent, to be honest, to be helpful, to connect, to have our interactions be beneficial, not to our, just to ourselves, but to the greater good. Then you begin to start your Kong-on training. And you very quickly realize that these old Zen masters have been talking out of both sides of their mouth for centuries. What's up with that? You don't need to look any farther than one of the first Kong-ons that we present to students to work on. It's called Zhaozhou's Wu, and it's very short, but it's very profound. It goes like this. A monk once asked Zhaozhou, who was arguably one of the most insightful awakened Zen masters in the entire history of Zen. He asked, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Now, most of us know that Buddha said everything has Buddha nature. This is an important teaching because it means even I, even you, all around the room, all of us have Buddha nature. Not only that, all things have Buddha nature. That means we need to respect everything we encounter in the world. We need to recognize that everything deserves respect, care, nurturing, nourishment. So the monk asked, "Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature?" We think of dogs as, usually starts with the word golden and has a dash after it nowadays, but we think of dogs as these loving companions that we have, beautiful animals, incredible creatures. But in ancient China, they were feral. They were mangy. They were filthy. They were thought of, I don't want to demean, what do we think of as the lowest form of life? The way people used to think of pigs, unclean, less than, what?
Cockroach.
Cockroach. Who will outlive us all, as we all know. So he's asking, does even a dog have Buddha nature? We don't know why the monk asked his question, what his point of view was. But I'd say it's a good bet that he expected his lofty teacher to recognize him as a good student and notice this particularly... Well, you can picture it for yourself, this kind of dog that comes up to them as the two of them are walking and says, even this has Buddha nature? And he probably expected Zhao Zhou to say, of course, you serious monk. I love your question and honor it, blah, blah, blah. And as you know, everything has Buddha nature, even that mangy, dirty little mutt. But Zhao Zhou said the exact opposite. He said, wu, which in Chinese means no. So Buddha said everything has Buddha nature. Zhao Zhou said everything doesn't have Buddha nature. Both of these figures fall directly in the line of trustworthy elders. There's even a longer version of this koan. Some say that the one that we work with is an abridged version of it, and I think that's likely. But there's a longer version in the Book of Serenity where one monk asked Zhao Zhou if a dog has Buddha nature, and he said, yeah. And a short time later, another monk asked if a dog has Buddha nature, and he said, no way. So who can you trust? As we continue our koan training, you begin to realize that these trickster-like moves that we just looked at with Zhao Zhou is rampant in our koan collection, rampant in the stories, especially the ones that come from the golden age of Zen in China when it really flowered for the first time. And if you've done some koan training, you start realizing that nearly every question that's asked in our collection has a hook in it, has a trap in it, a red herring. So watch out. Don't bite the hook. There's another koan in our collection that features Man Gong, who was one of Zen Master Sung San's teachers. And If you're not familiar with it, it's called Mangong's Net. And he told students, quote, "While you were all busy meditating, I had nothing to do, so I made a net. It's very strong and can catch all Buddhas, all patriarchs, and all human beings. It catches everything. So I ask you, how do you get out of the net?" He's laying the trap bare, and nobody could answer. Each time somebody offered an answer, he kept saying, "Caught another big fish," over and over and over. So our job is to actually see how we can get out of this net. So why would these great benevolent Zen masters do this to us? Why all the deceit? One simple reason, which I hope you've already understood, which is they want us to know for ourselves what is true and what is good. Not believing what others say until we confirm it for ourselves, just as Buddha said. They want us to trust our true self 100%. Trust your true self 100%. Boy, when I started practicing and I heard that, I didn't trust myself. I was always sincere and I always tried my best. But that sounds kind of unattainable. How do we trust our true self 100%? How do we know which way to go? How do we know what to do? How do we know when somebody has an ulterior motive? I think the word in there that's most important is the word true. He didn't say we want to trust ourselves. He said, trust your true self. So who is this true self? That also sounds like true self. Is that some kind of, I don't know, maybe Zhao Zhou had as a true self and he has found it. So it's an important question. It's not your ego-based self, because your ego-based self is clouded by your karmic inheritance, by your conditioning, by the beliefs that you hold true because they have been handed down to you by people of authority, by cultural systems, by, let's go back and see some of these things that Buddha said, because they have been spoken and rumored by many, because it's found written in your religious books, or the authority of teachers or elders. That's not your true self. And we all have karma. So, as we all know, a huge part of this practice is somehow to be able to see your karma, to be able to spot where you hold something as true that you've never examined, but you've just assumed. It's almost hard-baked in us. And for each of us, it's a little bit different. So this true self is the self that our ongoing practice leads us toward. All weekend, we've been practicing returning to that aspect of mind over and over and over again. Whether we're doing sitting meditation or we're in the Dharma dialogue room, this protocol we have. We don't have a recipe for what to do, but we have a protocol, and it's always returning to this mind that Zen Master Sung Sang called before thinking mind. So all of our senses are engaged and connected to this moment. We're awake, we're present, we're keeping a spaciously wide mind, but we're not attaching to thoughts or feelings. We're not following the storyline of the ego. Of course, we do all of that, but our training is when we notice that we're doing that, we just let that go and we come back to this, return to this before thinking mind. When we're in the Dharma dialogue room, our Kongon tradition follows, in a sense, that same protocol. We read a Kongon. We're asked a question. And we hit the floor. What a weird thing that is, right? Where did that come from? It's not just a tradition that we have all agreed on. Actually, that sound, the sound of hitting the floor, brings the teacher and the student's mind and the sound all together as one. And it just, maybe for a nanosecond, clears out all this excess baggage, this karmic baggage that we carry around with us all the time. And when that happens, we have a chance to just see the fresh truth of this moment. Not the moment a minute ago, not the moment back home when we were trying to decide what would be a good answer. Whatever. And although that may have been valid back home or a minute ago, every moment is absolutely fresh. So we have to do that over and over and over again. That's what's being referred to as our true self. Or that's how, maybe it's better to say, that's how we can connect with that. So let's bow to our compassionate / trickster ancestors. They've left so many great gifts for us that keep teaching us through coming down through the centuries to today. But don't say I didn't warn you.